So sorry I'm a little late. The printers don't seem to be working for me at the moment, so we'll see how well I can do off book, as it were. But let's start by seeing if there's any questions from, you know, anything we did last week. No? Okay. So anyway, the theme of this week is going to be quantum algorithms and complexity. So today I wanted to kind of give you an introduction to complexity theory, which is a computer science topic that's dealing with the question of how do you classify problems, computational problems, by how difficult they are. So maybe your first shot at that would be to say, oh, well, a problem is difficult if it takes a long time to solve it, and it's easy if it takes a short time to solve it, which is, of course, the kind of conceptual notion of what you want, but there's a couple of problems with it. So first of all, obviously this depends a lot on what machine you're running it on, right? If you're running it on a, you know, a 1950s mainframe, it's going to take a long time for any problem that we would think was worth doing today. Whereas, you know, it might be something that's actually very, very quick on one of today's computers. So you can kind of get around that by, instead of counting the total time, by counting the number of computational steps you have to do, right? That's a kind of more machine-invariant thing. Although, of course, even that is not completely machine-invariant. In the sense that different operating systems will have a different set of basic instructions that you can use, and, you know, converting one to the other might somewhat change the number of computational steps you have to do in order to complete the program. And of course, the programming language you write it in can matter a lot as well. So let's see. Let's try to kind of formalize the way we talk about these things. Okay. So yeah, before I do that, let's take one more issue that arises here. So when you then start to look at this even more closely, so you say, okay, so how long does it take? How many computational steps does it take to solve this particular problem? Well, if you think about it, you have this problem, like, you know, so the example I'm going to give in a minute is finding out if a number is prime, determining if a number is prime. So somebody gives you a very big number, and you want to say, is this number prime or not? Well, the answer is either yes or no, right? And so there's actually a very short program that outputs that answer. If it's yes, the program says print yes. If the answer is no, it says print no. Okay? Now, obviously, that's kind of dumb because you haven't actually solved the problem, right? It's just you put the answer into the program. But, you know, the answer is in the program, right? It has a particular value. And so the upshot is that it's not really meaningful to talk about the complexity of a single question like that. All you can do is talk about the complexity of sets of questions, how hard it is to find if a number is prime. And then you can look at the function that says, given the input n, outputs, you know, true or false, depending on if n is prime or not. Okay? And then you can say how long as a function of n, or as we'll see, as a function of the size of n, number of bits in n, does it take to solve this problem? And that's the complexity of this question. So let's try to formalize that. So in computer science, they like to write this in terms of something called languages. Okay, so first of all, notation. So 0, 1, star is the set of all bit strings. Of arbitrary length. So it's the empty string and the string 0, the string 1, but also the string 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, and things of all lengths. And then a language is simply a subset of 0, 1 star. So language is a set of bit strings. And the idea here is that, so this is the kind of the intuition behind the definition. So we say a bit string is in the language if the computational, the associated function on X is true. And then X is not in the language otherwise. And so in this kind of interpretation, we say that X is, so in this first case, we say X is a yes instance of L. And X is a no instance if X is not in L. And more generally, you just say it's an instance when you don't know what the answer is. Okay? So an example, as I said, is primality testing. So primes is the language of X such that X is prime. Here, X is a positive integer. Okay, so there's kind of an asymmetry in this definition, right? So we're choosing the yes instances to be the one that are in the set. And so this primes question is the set of X that are prime. But you could also have kind of the dual question, which is where the language is the set of X that are composite. I guess one kind of gets left out there. And that's, you know, in some sense, an equivalent computational question. But you'll see that some of this complexity theoretic stuff can depend on that. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so, so what is the complexity of this language, primes? Well, there's kind of an obvious algorithm to solve this, which is you take the number that you're given and you try to divide it by 2 and then by 3 and then by 5. Or, you know, if you don't want to keep track of all the primes, you just try dividing by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And once you get up to X, or really even the square root of X, if you haven't found anything that divides into it, you know it's prime. Okay. The problem is that takes a really long time, right? So if X is a 1,000-bit number, then you have to divide by, you know, well, if you're trying everything, it's 2 to the 500 different numbers before you can determine that it's definitely not, but definitely prime. Now, it could be that there's some values of X that is very easy. Like if X is even, you'll divide by 2 and you'll say, oh, it's not prime, right? Or if it's a multiple of 3 or some other small number, it's very easy to determine that it's not prime. But this algorithm sometimes takes a very, very long time. Okay, so that's the first thing, is that when we think about complexity, usually we're considering the worst case complexity. So you don't have to do that, but that's definitely the most common thing. And part of the reason for doing that is that when you're presented with a problem, the input that you're given is not actually chosen totally randomly. There's some reason behind the number that appeared there, or the input that appeared there. And it might be a reason that makes it hard. It might be a reason that makes it easy. You don't really know. But that's why it's nice to have a good worst case complexity guarantee. And for the moment, we're just going to deal with deterministic algorithms. So there's no randomness in the algorithm either. But of course, once we get to quantum algorithms, we're going to have to relax that and use randomized algorithms. Let's see. OK. So I gave you this algorithm for solving primality testing, but it takes a really long time. And you might say, well, maybe there's a better algorithm. And that would be reasonable. Well, we don't want the complexity of the problem to depend on the choice of the algorithm we want. Indeed, what we should say is it's the complexity of the best algorithm to solve this problem. So we're going to pick the best algorithm for the worst input. That's the worst input for that algorithm, right? Obviously, different algorithms might have different hard cases where they behave on their worst case. Okay, so now as you start to think about this a bit more, you might say, okay, that algorithm that I gave before takes time, Well, if x has n bits, it takes time like roughly 2 to the n over 2. Okay, so that's a pretty bad algorithm. Now, if you improve it by only dividing by the primes up to the square root, well, you have to try fewer things. So it's still exponential in n, the number of bits, but it's a lower exponential. It's actually sub-exponential, I guess. But then somebody else comes up with another algorithm, and it turns out that there's actually some pretty efficient algorithms to doing this. So you say, okay, so that is the complexity of this problem. But the thing is that even that function that you come up with, whatever it is, n to the third, I don't actually know what the best time, the best algorithm is right now, suppose it's n to the third. Even that is going to depend a little bit on the machine that you use, right? So certainly there's some constant factors that could be different, right? So if you're using one gate instruction set versus another gate set, that might create some small constant factor in converting between them. That's one factor. But also the general architecture of the machine can have more influence. I mean, we only talked about circuits, but there's lots of other models of computation. There's, for instance, the Turing machine, which is not a very realistic thing, but it's a perfectly valid model of computation. And that might take a bit longer or shorter. If you are doing circuits, but you're arranging nearest neighbor gates only in one dimension or two dimensions or three dimensions, those will all give different values, right? You might have to move information around, which could take a significant amount of time. And the upshot is, if you consider all these different models of computation, that n cubed might become n to the fifth, or n squared, or whatever. So even that number that I said, n cubed, is not going to be machine independent. And what we'd really like out of complexity is that it be completely machine independent. So the upshot is. We define a complexity class to be a set of languages. Now, of course, most complexity classes that you can come up with are not going to be very interesting ones. But the ones that are interesting are the ones that kind of have natural definitions and are robust under small changes in those definitions. So in particular, the complexity class P is set of languages that can be decided in time that is polynomial in the input size. Okay, so I guess I need to unpack a couple of things about this definition. This is the downside of not having my notes. So the instance I defined as, you know, X, which might or might not be in the language. Then we say that we can decide the language using an algorithm. I guess here I can add this to the definition. So an algorithm is basically some function that, you know, takes the input and applies a series of computational steps. And the exact set of computational steps might depend on the size of the input, naturally. But you don't usually have it depend on the input itself, right? That's just what it runs on. But we say that this algorithm decides a language if A of X outputs 1, if X is in the language, and A of X outputs 0, if X is not in the language. Okay, so it's giving the right answer for determining if X is a yes instance or no instance. Okay, and so the subtext here is that by focusing on languages, I'm focusing only on questions that have yes or no answers. Like, is this number prime? And you know, most problems can, in fact, be phrased this way or as a sequence of such things, but it takes a little bit of sleight of hand sometimes to make it work right. And some questions that are still interesting just can't be phrased this way. But this is nevertheless the kind of standard starting point for complexity theory. Okay, and so the advantage of this class P, it's only saying that the running time of this algorithm is polynomial in the size of the input. So it doesn't really distinguish between n and n squared and n cubed. They're all in P. Okay? And the reason for that is this issue about switching between machines. So let's think a little bit more about what different types of computational machines can do. The first question, you might wonder, well, actually, if I'm really being careful, is it really true that a Turing machine can decide the same set of languages as the circuit model, right? Because there's a famous result, not of complexity theory, this is of computability, that says that not all languages can be decided. Okay, this is Turing's discovery of the halting problem as an example of a language that cannot be decided. So what is the halting problem? Well, given the you know, some computer program, decide whether this program will halt or not in a finite amount of time. But it's not saying how much time, right? It could be 10 steps, it could be a million steps, it could be 10 to the 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 10 steps. We have no way of knowing ahead of time how long it's going to run. You know, or if it somehow enters some sort of infinite loop or just keeps on, you know, getting larger and larger numbers involved or whatever. And so this problem actually cannot be solved on a computer of the sort that we normally think about. There's a relatively straightforward proof of that, but I don't really want to go into it because it's a bit of a digression from what we're talking about. But the upshot is that you don't know a priori that your machine can solve all problems. It can't solve all problems. And so you might ask, what about these different kinds of machines? Can they actually solve different sets of problems? That would undermine this whole project of defining complexity theory independent of machines, right? Because you might say, oh, well, you know, this problem is unsolvable on a Mac, but a PC, it can solve it. But then there's this other problem that the PC can't solve and the Mac can solve, right? So they'd have just different, not just complexity classes, but different problems of different sets of computable functions. But it turns out, as far as we know, that that is not true. So this is known as the Church-Turing thesis. So the set of computable problems, or decidable languages, is another way of phrasing this. Is the same on every physically reasonable computer. In every physically reasonable computational model. Okay, and I have to add this physically reasonable caveat because it's actually not that difficult to come up with unreasonable models that can solve some of these problems. So for instance, if you have analog computing with infinite precision, right, then you know you can do stuff that involves you know totally crazy irrational numbers that you don't even know how to write down, but somehow give you the answer to the problem. But once you add finite precision, then that analog computer becomes just a digital computer, or can be simulated on a digital computer by, you know, it has 100 bits of precision, so let's just have 100 bits that are dedicated to one register of this analog computer. Okay?
So this is just saying that machines, physically reasonable machines, can't do better than a Turing machine, right?
In terms of what can be computed.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because you can also make weaker machines, right? It's not.
Yeah, that's true. And I should say that this Church-Turing thesis also holds true for quantum computers. So why is that? Well, a quantum computer does a set of unitary operations, right? And so in principle, you can simulate a quantum computer on a regular classical computer by writing down each unitary operation as a big 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix and multiplying those matrices out, okay? Obviously, this is a very slow algorithm. It's exponential in the number of qubits, but it will give you the answer, right? So any function that you can compute on a quantum computer, you can also compute on a classical computer by multiplying out matrices, okay? So quantum computers are not a challenge to the Church-Turing thesis. But as people, you know, started to develop complexity theory, they realized that this was not enough, right? They also wanted the set of efficiently computable functions. Yeah, OK, I should say that if a language is in P, we say it is efficiently computable. So this class P is then become the proxy for things that are easy. And things that are not in P are hard, okay? And we would like that this class to be well-defined. So it shouldn't depend on the computational model we're using. And so that brings us to the strong Church-Turing thesis. And so the strong Church-Turing thesis takes this Church-Turing thesis and adds a complexity aspect to it by saying that complexity in different physically reasonable computational models differs by only a polynomial. And it's a strong Church-Turing thesis which tells us that this complexity class P is something that's going to be the same on all different kinds of computers. Okay? Because it says that if you have an algorithm that runs in time n cubed on one computer, well, on a different computational model, it might be n or n to the fifth or n to the 27th, but it'll still be polynomial. Right? It can only blow up by polynomial factor. And vice versa. So, so the strong Church-Turing thesis was a very well-established part of classical computer science. And it showed that you could, as long as you're dealing with complexity classes that are only vary up to these polynomial factors, that's a sensible thing to look at. But quantum computers provide a challenge to that. Quantum computers, they have problems in them, I mean, problems that we can solve on quantum computers that we don't know how to solve on a classical computer in polynomial time. And moreover, we don't know how to simulate a quantum computer in polynomial time on a classical computer. So it definitely appears that the strong Church-Turing thesis is only true for classical computational models. Although I should say there seems to be something kind of analogous for quantum computational models. That there's quantum models that differ by up to polynomial factors, like again, a quantum gate network in 1D versus 2D or 3D. But you know, if you use quantum field theory, if you, you know, build your computer using adiabatic quantum computing, things like that, they only seem to differ by polynomial factors. Okay, so I guess I forgot to tell you that this primes problem is an example of a problem that's in the complexity class P. The algorithm to decide it in polynomial time is not at all obvious. It was discovered in the early 2000s. Now, for a long time, there was a randomized algorithm which is also not totally obvious. Really, not obvious at all, I should say, that can decide for primality testing, and it was eventually discovered that it was actually a deterministic algorithm as well. So now maybe we can talk about. Well, okay, let me stop and see if there's questions on this.
Is it really MP?
Primes. Yeah. You have your computer. Look up primes in P.
Yeah.
Um, So the yeah, like I said, it took a long time to discover that. But you have to apply some, you know, some actual number theory on the structure of primes in order to be able to solve this. Even with a randomized algorithm. Are there questions? Yeah.
Should that be h of x equals 0 in the top right hand corner?
Yeah. Sure. Anything else? Yeah.
You're talking about the using the best algorithm. Is that just like the currently best?
No. So when we're defining whether something is in a complexity or class or not, we want to know the actual best algorithm. Of course, that makes it hard to determine, right? Because we don't know whether we have the actual best algorithm. And this is going to be a recurrent problem in complexity theory. We're not going to do too much complexity theory. But that creates a one-sided thing, right? So before this deterministic primality testing algorithm was discovered, primes was not known whether it was in P or not. But once it was discovered, now we know it's in P. Okay? And so, for instance, we'll talk later this week about factoring. Right? Factoring is not known to be in P. But it could be. Right? It's just no one's been able to discover an algorithm to do that. So showing that something is in a language, it's clear how to do that. Showing that something is not in a language, that's much less clear. And that's actually a good starting point for the next question. So one way we can show something is not in a language, we can't really prove, except in very special cases, that something is not in a language. It's certainly not a big, well-defined language like P. But what we can do is show that solving this problem would be very surprising in polynomial time. And so the way we go about that is we think of more difficult computational classes. Okay? Computational classes that have kind of an unreasonable amount of power, and that it seems unlikely that you could solve everything in that computational class. So the main such class I'll be introducing is the class NP. So NP is going to be defined in terms of a function, an additional function, f of xw, that has the following properties. So x here is the instance that we're trying to decide. W is called a witness. Well, okay. W is only called a witness when there exists one. So F runs in polynomial time in the size of X. And if x in the language, then there exists w such that Well, it runs in polynomial time in the length of x and w. So such that the length of w is polynomial in the length of x. And f of xw equals 1. And if x is not in the language, then there does not exist witness such that this is true. Yes, I'm not totally sure how this polynomial factor comes in. Basically, usually the witness, the kind of the size of the expected witness is already given, and so it's not really varying with the specific x. But well, there's a bound on the witness size anyway. Anyway, so what does this definition mean? So the definition says that given an instance that we're trying to decide, well, this function does not decide the problem. What it does is it gives us a way of checking that it's a yes instance or a no instance. Okay. So if it's a yes instance, I can give you this witness w, and then you have a polynomial time algorithm that will say, yes, it is indeed a yes instance. Whereas if you have a no instance, no matter what w I give you, that's not going to work, right? There's not exist. So for any w, f of x of w is 0. Okay? Or at least for all, w within the length limit. Okay? So let's look at an example of that. This is the three-sat problem, three satisfiability. So three-sat is a class of Boolean formulas, a set of Boolean formulas. So the instances we interpret, right? So this is another aspect of this definition is that so in this case. The instances bit strings which we just interpreted as numbers, okay? But of course, in a computer, you can everything is a set of bit strings. You can interpret it as words. You can interpret it as some mathematical formula, and that's what we want to do in this case. So the bit string is going to be interpreted as a Boolean formula, and the Boolean formulas have the following form. So they're the AND of clauses, and each clause is the OR of three variables or their negations. They don't have to be the same. So as a sub-example, one clause could be like x1 or x2 or not x3. So this little wedge here is an OR. And the other kind of wedge is an AND. So an example of a Boolean formula would be x1 or x2 or not x3, and x1 or x3. Or x4, and then maybe not x2 or not x4. Okay. So let's say less than or equal to 3. You can make it exactly 3. It doesn't really change things. I also didn't. Okay. So notice that the variables can definitely be repeated between clauses. It's fine to repeat them in the clause. That would be one way of going from this thing to 3. I could say not x2 or not x2 or not x4. And that would just be the same as this. So anyway, so how would you solve this? Well, it's not straightforward, right? So my claim is that 3sat is in NP. Why is that? Well, while it's difficult to solve this problem, it's very easy to check the answer if I give it to you. So if I say, let's try a truth assignment of x1 and x2 are true, and x3 and x4 are false. Well, x1 is true, so this is satisfied. And this one is satisfied. X2 is true, so this part is not, but x4 is false, so this part is true. So you can see that that assignment that I gave you works, right? And that was quick to check. You just went through and checked each clause, and you see, yes, this, I didn't define what was in the language. So we say formula C is in 3sat if there exists assignment of the variables. Such that that on this assignment, C evaluates, well, I guess I could do x0 to xn minus 1 is true. Okay, so in that truth assignment that I gave you, it is true. So that means that this particular formula is in 3sat. Okay? And 3sat is in the class NP because what's the checking function? Well, you just evaluate the formula. The witness then is the satisfying assignment. But you see, if there's no satisfying assignment, then any assignment of variables will give you the output false. Okay? So it satisfies these two parts of the definition, and therefore it's an NP.
Wait.
Yeah.
So if you have x and not x, that's 3sat, right? But there's no assignment of variables, that makes it true.
That's correct.
So
that's an instance of 3sat, but it's a no instance of 3sat, not a yes instance. So remember, the language is defined as the set of yes instances.
So
this is just a kind of the quirks of the way these definitions actually work.
So you're giving this formula, and the language is all of the variable assignments that make that a yes.
That's right, right. So that's what we defined over here. Right.
I see.
This is why this language of saying this terminology of saying something is an instance of the language is useful, because that doesn't presuppose whether it's a yes or a no instance.
Okay. I thought the language was all possible formulas of.
So this is the actual definition of 3sat here.
Okay.
Okay. This is, as I said, this is the instances. So this is the set of things that we have to think about. This is how we're going to interpret the input. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so so it turns out that not only is 3sat in NP, but it's one of the hardest problems in NP. So how can I possibly make such a claim? Right? I said it was very difficult to determine exactly how hard a problem is. Yeah, I'm going to tell you, don't worry. And so the way to do that is through the notion of reduction. Maybe I should put this on a new board. Too important to stick all the way in the corner here. That didn't work. Okay, let's do the manual. Okay. So reduction is a way of rewriting one language in terms of another. So what specifically, it's a function on bit strings. That's the right definition. So so we take instances of L and we map them to instances of M. And the output is in M if and only if the input is in L, right? So what this means is that if we have an algorithm to decide the language M, well, okay. So this function doesn't have to be one-to-one. It doesn't have to be one-to-one, and it doesn't have to be onto. Generally, it will be one-to-one, but that's not essential. So in particular, that means that there might be some instances of M that are not in the range of this function F, right? So this reduction is kind of a one-way thing. It doesn't have to be both directions. Sometimes there are reductions in both directions, but then that's a separate question. And so suppose we have an algorithm to decide M. Okay? Then we can use it decide L. Well, how do we do that? Well, given X, then we decide F of X, right? So we map X to using F to an instance of M. Then we decide it using the algorithm. And because of this condition, we know that whatever answer we get is going to be the same as the question of whether it's in L or not, right? So if we decide that f of x is in M, that means that x had to be in L. And if we decide that f of x is not in M, that means that x is not in L. Okay, so we've decided L. Okay, and what this means is that and this is a little bit confusing about this terminology, is it means that M is a harder problem than L, right? Because it's saying that if we can solve M, we can also solve L. So you're reducing it to a harder problem, basically. I mean, it might not be harder. It has to be at least as hard, right? And so if there's reductions in both directions, then you can say that these two problems are of the same difficulty. Yeah?
This terminology doesn't quite sit well with the Church Turing thesis, at least it doesn't seem like. According to the Church Turing thesis, all problems should be equally hard. Either you can decide them or you cannot.
Okay, so the Church Turing thesis, and not the strong Church Turing thesis, doesn't make any statement about complexity. It's only about computability.
This thing also doesn't talk about.
Yeah, but it will in a second, because actually, what I've said down here is hand wavy, and it's missing a very important point. So with the Kirch-Turing thesis, you can still talk about reductions in terms of the Kirch-Turing thesis. Oh, yeah, oh, well, OK. Why don't I finish this definition and put in the appropriate parts? But if you look at this approach here, you realize that there's a hole in it, right? Suppose this function f takes an enormous amount of time to compute, right? So what I wrote is correct, sort of. In the context of the computability theory, I guess it's not completely correct, because f could be even uncomputable, not just a long time to compute. So what we normally care about is not just reductions, but reductions, first of all, that such that f is computable, but more importantly, it's computable in a reasonable amount of time, right? And so for instance, if we're dealing with a class P, we should deal with a polytime reduction so that this function f is itself computable in polynomial time, right? Because otherwise, this whole approach would be bottlenecked by the amount of time it takes to do the reduction. And actually, when people are dealing with P and with NP, they usually use something that's even less than polynomial time. They'll use like log space or something like that. That's not that important. But the point is there's different kinds of reductions depending on the strength of f. And we want f to be efficiently computable. So just think of it as polynomial time computable. That'll be enough for this class.
It just needs to be no more slower than the main algorithm you're using to decide m, right?
Yeah, roughly speaking. Then the really should be no slower than the complexity class that you're worried about. I mean, if this main algorithm is an n squared algorithm, and your reduction is an n cubed reduction, then let's see. I guess the overall algorithm this way will be an n cubed thing, but that will still be within P.
Okay,
and that would still be acceptable for a lot of purposes. Right. Okay. So. And then we say that a language is NP complete. Language L is NP complete if, first of all, L is in NP. And okay, let me try to be consistent here. So I'm going to call it M. If M is in NP, and for all other languages in NP, there exists, let's say, a polytime reduction from L to M. Okay? So what this is saying is that if we can solve M, then we can solve any problem in NP, right? By simply using one of these reductions to convert it into an instance, given an instance of whatever language L we're interested in, we can use this reduction to convert it into an instance of M. That takes polynomial time. And if we have a polynomial time algorithm for M, then we have a polynomial time algorithm for L. And therefore, and L was an arbitrary thing in NP, okay? And so that's the sense in which we can say these NP complete problems are the hardest ones in NP. So 3SAT is an example, not just of NP, but 3SAT is actually NP complete. So this is the famous Cook-Levin theorem. Um, So that's the sense in which we can say, well, it seems unlikely that we can solve 3-sat, right? Because if we could solve 3-sat, then we could solve all of these NP problems. And I mean, I guess that's not totally impossible, but it would be very surprising, because you can come up with all sorts of kind of interesting and seemingly hard problems, like 3-sat, that are in NP. And so what we believe is that these complexity classes look like this. NP is a, you know, a strict superset of P. But it's, you know, it's a very famous open problem: is P equal to NP? If you could solve this problem, you'd get, you know, all sorts of awards, be world famous. But you know, we don't really have a good sense of how to solve this problem. This is not one of those problems that's like, we're almost on the verge of cracking. Well, maybe someone, you know, somewhere has a great idea that's not public yet. But it's a, you know, a perennial cornerstone of computer science. And of course, part of the reason that it's so hard to solve this problem is precisely this question that we had before of you know, whether a problem is in P or not depends on the best algorithm. And we have no way of figuring out what the best algorithm is. Okay, so there are questions on this.
How about people excited that quantum computers might solve NP problems, some NP problems, efficiently?
So we don't believe that quantum computers can solve NP complete problems. Okay. And I'll kind of get into a little bit that more later this week. But there's some problems, as we'll discuss, that we believe are outside P but can still be solved by quantum computer. Mm-hmm. We'll discuss the kind of the quantum analog of P tomorrow. Yeah.
P complete problems.
There are P complete problems. Obviously, if you're dealing with polynomial time reduction, then every problem in P is a P complete problem, right? Because what's the polynomial reduction? Well, you solve the problem and then, you know, you convert it to, you know, trivial instances of this other problem. But it is meaningful if you start to talk about weaker reductions. What there's not, I believe, is kind of very natural kind of, so this 3-sat problem is one that you can definitely imagine just coming up with, right? And there's lots of other NP complete problems that are just, you know, this is the problem you want to solve. Right, you just came up in for some other reason, and it happens to be NP complete. I don't think there's analogous problems for P in the same sense. I guess I don't really know much about P complete problems. People mostly don't think about it because they're already easy, right? So it's yeah, there's definitely some literature on it. I guess don't know much. Any other questions?
Quantum computers solve problems outside of NP.
We'll discuss that too. But we think so, yes. Okay. So next time we actually will talk about quantum stuff. I promise.